G'day, Hamish McDonald here. I'm a journalist and I've spent the last 18 months deep in the dark world of mis- and disinformation. So what is the difference? Well, disinformation has malicious intent behind it. It's designed specifically to deceive using false information, kind of like propaganda. Whereas misinformation is false information that might be shared by someone who believed it to be true. So who's behind this modern form of propaganda? Find out by streaming The Matter of Facts now on ABC iView.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Many years ago, I used to teach English language to high school kids. The students came from all over the world, from Korea, the Middle East, and Indonesia. And one of the books we used in the course was Melina Marchetta's young adult novel, Looking for Alla Brandi. And all these kids from such different places loved that book. So many of them identified with the story it told of a big immigrant family, one where there's no privacy, but at the same time, a ton of secrets. The kind of family that can feel like the happiest, safest tribe one minute, and like a prison cell you're desperate to escape the next. Melina Marchetta was writing what she knew and looking for Alla Brandi. She'd grown up in Sydney as part of an extended Italian network of siblings and cousins and grandparents, and she assumed one day she'd have her own kids. But by the time she reached her 40s, that hadn't happened. So Melina made some different decisions, and a little girl called Bianca came to sit alongside her at that big Sicilian family table for Sunday lunch. Welcome to Conversations, Melina.
Thank you, Sarah.
Tell me about your mum and dad. Where did your mum grow up?
She grew up in Eyre, North Queensland. She was a product of pre-World War II migration. My grandfather came out in the 1920s and he returned to Sicily in the early 30s to marry my grandmother, but then they came back. And
what was he doing up there in North Queensland?
He was cutting cane. He came out with his two brothers. And it was really hard for me to reconcile myself with this image because he was kind of a stern man. But when he came out in the 20s, he bought a horse and he got a tattoo of a topless mermaid on his shoulder. And as I said, if you knew my grandfather... but I just think that that actually showed his spirit before the responsibility of his life.
Did you ever see that tattoo? Did he show it to you as a kid?
Well, when you go and visit your grandfather in North Queensland, they've got the blue singlets. And the one thing I remember when he was dying was, you know, because his skin had, you know, thinned out, it was so vibrant. Like, we couldn't get over. I remember we were having this beautiful discussion about the vibrancy of this this tattoo, which would have been over, you know, 50 years old. So just a very complex man. And so my mother and my aunt were a product of that marriage, and that's how she came to end up in Eyre, I suppose.
Did the family own their own farm, their own sugarcane farm?
No, they didn't. He was never able to do that. His friends were certainly, cane farm owners, but my grandfather was interned during World War II because the Italians were interned because they were on the Italy was on the German side at the time. And as a result, he was taken away and my grandmother had to take over. She had to look after these two kids and she was chopping wood one day and she had a terrible accident and had internal injuries and it affected her for the rest of her life. So he really spent, when he eventually was released, and they would not release him, although the family needed help, when he was eventually released, he spent a lot of his time driving her to Townsville, for medical care. So they weren't really able to afford to own a farm. But he was never, I have to say, the one thing I loved about my grandfather and my grandparents in general, there was never any looking back. There was never any bitterness. And there probably should have been. He had... You know, when he came out to Australia, he had renounced, he signed a document renouncing Italy. He was, you know, a British subject, and he was entitled to everything that a British subject was entitled to, yet he was interned. But as I said, he just thought, you don't look back. And he never went back to Sicily either. So he was just the type to you never look back.
It must have been incredibly hard work on those cane fields. This is just using hand machetes.
Yeah, we have amazing photos, you know, of the, you know, the cane farmers lined up, and they look so young. And, yeah, they're holding, you know, these tools in their hands when you've seen cane cutting change over time. But it was such an amazing, I mean, it was such hard work, but such an amazing time for communities to start developing, because of course someone had found out these three brothers had come out. That's how people started coming out to that area. They would find out that someone from their hometown was there, and gradually, you know, you would easily end up in the same town in Queensland as, you know, you had grown up with in Sicily. So
you heard a story about your granddad giving away a shilling when you were older and visiting air. What's that story?
I went to I was up there for work, and a 21st was on, so of course I ended up there. And someone came up to me and she said, "I've got a story for you." And I hear that often. And I thought, okay. And she said, we came out in the early 1960s, and they came out, you know, by plane. And she was describing this feeling of just being so lost, and, you know, imagine how it felt to be coming out and starting anew with her brothers. And she said, "I'll always remember that there were three men there and your grandfather was one of them." She said, "I didn't know him, but he gave us all, I think it was a shilling, and he shook our hands and he said, 'Welcome to the country.'" And I remember I was standing there at this 21st and I started crying. It was such a beautiful story, once again, to find out about him.
So he met them at the airport.
He met them at the airport.
And welcomed them.
Yeah, because that's what they did back then. If they knew that someone was coming from, you know, the old country, you know, for them it was important, and it wasn't around the corner. They had to travel for quite a while, but it was important for them to welcome them. And I just thought it was such a beautiful story to hear about welcoming people into this country who are feeling lost, who, you know, who don't really have anywhere else to go. And I was just, once again, there was that pride of the generosity of my family.
How did your mum, growing up there in North Queensland, how did she meet your dad?
She was, my mum was another interesting character. She was such a smart, she wasn't ambitious, but she was just such a spirited, I suppose, young woman. She was only 17. She was the first Sicilian girl in that town to get a job. And she worked for the union, which I love as well. And her job was to go up to whoever was, they called them the, you know, whoever was coming off the boats, to register them for cane cutting. And that's how she approached my dad in the street. And she said, you know, you could always tell the Italians off the boat because they were wearing, you know, baggy pants. And she said, we just thought they looked gorgeous, you know. And my father
probably
was
a hat as
My father was so handsome as well, but it was a relationship that they had to keep hidden because my grandfather was very strict. And it's funny, my mother said to me the other day, I rang her up about something, and she said, "Oh, your dad and I are just about to burn some letters." And I said, "Sorry, what's this?" And they had a box of letters that they had sent to each other through my aunt or a cousin, because they weren't allowed to communicate. And I said, "Why would you be burning these letters?" I said, "They're so important. First of all, they're important to me, and they're important to my sisters as well. But," I said, "they're a piece of history." And she told me later, she said, "I just didn't want people reading our personal, you know, information." And we decided that I would have the letters. They're in a box in my house.
Have you read them?
No, because they're in Italian, and I can't. I said to her, "Can you actually translate them?" She said, "Don't be ridiculous," because there's so many. But it was a beautiful love story, and as I said, it was it was quite a secret one.
How did they finally get approval to get married
I don't even know, because I think that my grandfather, I think deep down, knew that my father would take her away. And he was, you know, my mum was his, you know, one of his beloved daughters, and it was really heartbreaking for them. And, you know, there was also that view of they were such hard workers with the land, and, you know, his view was that the marketers weren't interested in getting their hands dirty.
Well, so they were a Sicilian family as well, the marketers. What was different about your dad's family?
They were probably, and I wouldn't say that they were in any way different with regards to money, but I think they thought themselves better than other people. Not other people, but they just had that aspect of snobbery. And my grandparents in Sicily used to own, I think it was one of those halfway houses where they fed people on their journeys. And, you know, my mother was, you know, very complimentary about my father's family and saying that they never made any money because they were so generous. So, but they were not going to stay in Ayr and do farm work. And so my parents got married when they were 21 and came straight down to Sydney, and my mum had to live with the entire Marchetta family, and that was pretty difficult.
But what does she say about that, or what have you observed about what that might have been like for
her? She was as much as my mum's so, I think she's so Sicilian in an Australian way, she was still the Australian, I wouldn't say uncouth, but, you know, she had a different upbringing to them. So she was the outsider. And also, I put it down to the fact that I think my mother was spoilt as well. So to really end up in a household with, I think, you know, there'd be about 8 or 9 people, including, by the time I was born, a couple of babies in there. So there was always advice about what she was doing wrong with us, and, you know, why I wasn't being breastfed, and why I rejected the breast. And, you know, it was all stuff like
that.
Sounds
like a really stressful way to have a baby.
I know. She's always said, don't ever live with in-laws. And she loves my father's family. They see each other every Sunday, and they have for, you know, so many years. But she is, you never live with family after you marry.
So how did they finally move into their own place then?
My father was delivering bread, and they just worked hard. And my mother's very Catholic, and she said, she said, I remember when we moved into that house, she said, I went to church and I was on my knees thanking God, you know, because by that, there were two of us by that stage, and the third was to come. But for her, it was that freedom of just being able to do her own thing and not being told that she was doing everything wrong. So it's just, yeah, it was just the way things were back then. But they would probably never have been able to afford to buy a house if they hadn't lived that way.
Did they move very far away?
No one in our family moves. Even now, it's really ridiculous. You know, there's a pretty big extended family, and we're probably the person who lives, we will say, oh, they live so far away and it's 15 minutes away. It's just ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous.
It's the Marchetta compound.
Yeah. We could end up in one whole street one day.
How important was Sunday lunch in your family, Melina, when you were growing up? What used to happen?
Well, my paternal grandmother was a matriarch. She ruled. And every Sunday everyone had to go there. And I always remember there were two tables, the kids' table and the adult table. We were very close together. And I just remember a lot of noise. And obviously it had to be the pasta lunch.
Who did all the cooking?
The women did. And it was the same, you know, it never changed. And we didn't expect it to change. That was Sunday lunch.
What was on the menu?
It was a bolognese or meatballs, and sometimes it was pork cooked in the sauce, and just variations of that. It's not quite a bolognese because the richness of that sauce is made through, you know, the meatballs that's in there. So that's pretty much. And they would, on a special occasion, they would actually make their own pasta without a pasta machine. It would be rolling, you know, the macaroni. And as I said, I remember we'd have little shandies because my grandfather spoiled us and he'd let us have them. And we just knew no other way. For me, that was the most exciting day for us, you know, once a week. It was like a carnival.
Was there a big moment where you transitioned from the children's table across to the adult table?
We always said that we were dying to, and then the moment we did, we were like, let's go back to... I think we were in our 20s, like, we're not interested in that table.
Give me that shandy, yeah, I'm heading back over there.
Yeah, it was just... it's you always kind of dream... I don't know, we could actually see that table, so it wasn't as if anything exciting was happening. And once in a while, one of the fathers would sit on our table because there wasn't enough room. But it was a beautiful way of life. And next door lived my great aunt and her family, so my grandmother's sister. So, you know, we've always, even in North Queensland, my grandfather lived next door, his sister, and next door was her first son, and across the road, two more sons. And that's the way we were so used to living. And it was exciting for us as children.
What was Tomato Day?
Tomato Day was, we would have to do it every year. We did not see it as anything exciting. That was definitely not an exciting day for us. And it was pretty much the tomatoes would have been collected and everyone had their role, whether it was to empty the, because they'd squeeze the juice out of the tomatoes and then there'd be the boiling of them and, you know,
this is to make tomato sauce.
Yes. And then that tomato sauce was stored in everyone's garage for the whole year. It was, I don't remember once in my childhood ever purchasing tomato sauce. So if we had pasta, my mother would say, can you go downstairs and get one of the sauce bottles? And, you know, you knew where to find it in the garage. And I was just in Melbourne recently and I was visiting a bookstore and the young woman there was Italian and she gave me a bottle that they had just made on the weekend, you know. But it was, as I got older and watched it, I was just so taken by the storytelling that took place, and it wasn't kind of this beautiful nostalgia. It was just talk. It was that dialogue that was very similar to the dialogue around tables. And I just remember my elegant aunts, you know, I think I wrote about this in my first novel. Someone had found a material because my aunt was a seamstress. So every woman in the backyard had the same, the same coloured apron, you know. So it was just... But there was just such a charm to it as an older person watching it, whereas when we were kids, it was such a long day.
What about life for you at school? Did you feel you had to hide your Italian-ness in any way, or had that changed by the time you were at school?
I had to hide the fact that I wasn't allowed to do anything. Our family view was the only people who can look after you is pretty much family. And... you know, we would, you know, we'd be invited to a party and I'd say, oh, no, we've got a wedding. We had a wedding every week when we actually didn't have a wedding.
But it was, you didn't want to say I'm not allowed to.
It was embarrassing to say I'm not allowed to. And it's funny when we, you know, because I'm still friends with, you know, my friends from school and we talk about what we did hide from each other. And my friends who aren't Italian, who are Aussie, they had their own stuff that they were hiding. And I really think it's interesting as adults when you find out things about their lives. And, you know, back then you thought, oh, gosh, no one's having a tougher time than I am. But there were a lot of things that were embarrassing, even in primary school. You know, your lunch was embarrassing because you did get mocked for it. So there were so many things that you did hide. And I loved school, but the toughest part I did find was that I wasn't Italian enough for the Italian girls and I wasn't Aussie enough for the Aussie girls. So that's why who I ended up with, this combination, I think we were meant to be. And, you know, our lives are so entwined now that we made the right decisions.
What kind of student were you at school?
I was, I would say that I struggled a bit, but I was also lazy. I loved reading, but I was a very late reader. I didn't start reading until I was, you know, in first grade or second grade. But I was just I used to sit in the back of, you know, English class. I can't believe I ended up being an English teacher and I'd be reading other books rather than, you know, the books.
What did you love reading?
I loved reading anything that had a romance in it. You know, I loved Anne of Green Gables. I remember discovering Pride and Prejudice, but only because of Darcy and Elizabeth, no other reason. I didn't appreciate what it was really worth until I was a lot older. But it was just, I think I didn't have confidence. The one subject that I loved so much was history, and I did get good marks for history. And the one thing I did learn from that, and especially with English as well, is my love for something got me somewhere. It wasn't just a fluke. So when Year 10 ended, I just remember thinking, I don't want to do the HSC. I felt that I would fail it. And I just didn't want to, I don't know whether I would have kind of recovered from that sort of failure. And I'm glad I didn't do my HSC at that time.
Did you have to fight your mum and dad to let you leave school?
Probably more my mum. And it wasn't a fight, it was just a great disappointment. But I always say my mum actually got me in a way that a lot of people didn't get me. And I remember an incident in primary school where she, you know, we were at parent-teacher night or day, and she said to the teacher, she's a slow and steady wins the race type of kid. And I remember being shocked because I thought, oh, yeah, I remember feeling that, but I didn't realise that she had noticed that. And that's why I appreciate that she's let me do things that she probably didn't want me to do, but she just knows or knew that I would get there in a way. So she agreed, but her deal was, you're 15, you're not going into the workforce. So she made me go to a Catholic business college where they covered our hands while we learned to type on typewriters, not computers. And that's my typing is brilliant as a result. So I'm very appreciative about that.
What job did you get after you graduated from the Catholic Business College?
I went into the bank for a couple of years, and I was just, you know, I was a secretary there. And then I ended up in town working for the legal department there. And it was when I was in legal that they had these big computers. I try not to say this too much you know, in public, but that's when I started writing Alibrundi at work because there was a computer and I was so excited. So I used to do my work first, and then I used to do some writing and race down to the printers because it was back when the printers were this massive room, and grab the stuff and race back again. But, you know, it was once again, I'm glad I went through all those little jobs. And then I ended up working. I knew I wanted something different, and I ended up working in a travel company and, you know, just earning hardly anything. But the big bonus was back in those days, you could if you worked for travel, you could end up, you know, traveling for $25 to Europe. What? And, yeah, it was just amazing.
Where were you living while you were working and you know, I guess entering your late teens, your early 20s?
I was still living at home. There was no way that I was ever going to be able to move out of home. Back then, Italian girls, I suppose, moved out of home if they got married or if they had their own place, which was pretty difficult. So for me, I was living at home, which is where I wrote Looking for Alibrundi, in my bedroom, in my parents' home. And you know, it wasn't strict in the sense, by that stage, of course, we were allowed to go out, but my mother would still wait up for us. She would say, I just cannot sleep if you're not home. So you were kind of, you know, guilty about the fact that if you got home at 2 o'clock in the morning, there she was waiting for you to get home. And not to check what you had done, you know, it was just that worry, that constant worry.
That must have been such a contrast, travelling overseas by yourself. How did you manage that compared to this very close-knit, watched-over family?
I just felt, I always felt as if I didn't want to run away from them, but I wanted to run away, you know, for a period of, I just wanted to work out who I was. And, you know, to get this job, and of course, sometimes people couldn't travel with you because, you know, you were traveling sometimes once or twice a year. And so my only way of that freedom was to travel. And when I think about it now, I would never do it now. I remember going to Beijing and taking a train to Moscow. And
by yourself?
By myself. I was petrified. I was in this cabin where every time I stepped out, you know, all these men would beckon me, you know, just to have a chat in there. In their little cabin. And I remember the toilet was putrid, so I couldn't even go near it. But it was still, I think what traveling taught me was that I really enjoyed my own company and that I could handle quite a lot of situations, even someone as bashful as myself. And I remember getting to Moscow, I had met people on the train, on a first train, fleetingly. They were English, they were working for, I think, the QE2 and these drunk American guys. And I saw them in Red Square in Moscow, and I just remember running up to them saying, "Can I hang out with you guys?" And I just remember running through the streets of Moscow for the next couple of days. But it was just that feeling of... it's not that I'm not home and people aren't controlling me. It's just, oh, my God, the world.
When did you first go to Italy?
I first went when I was 19 with my sister. And it was, I had always been told, because we always spoke about feeling in between, I had always been told that if I went to Italy, I would step off that plane and I would know I was home. That's where I would belong. And, of course, that didn't happen at all. It was kind of a crazy feeling to think I was going to have. And I'm not saying for one moment that I thought I got nothing out of it, but the beauty of it was going to Sicily and sitting around the table with my great aunts. And, you know, this was in the 80s. My father's family had left in the early 50s, and my great aunts were still crying, thinking of the day that my grandmother and her children left. And, you know, you just take for granted how quick a plane trip is and the fact you'll see everyone again. But for them, they didn't see some of the members of their family ever again. And it was after that trip that I came home and I said to my mum, "I'm going to write a novel about, you know, I don't know, about our lives and especially her father, because he was interned and he came out in the 30s and the horse and the tattoo." And sadly, my grandfather got Alzheimer's and he had no memory left of anything.
So you had to write your own Looking for Ella Brandy instead.
Yes, with my grandmother, with my gorgeous, ditzy maternal grandmother.
Melina, you were writing Looking for Ella Brandy at work when no one was looking and at your parents' home, in your bedroom at your parents' home. When you started sending it out to publishers, what kind of response did you get?
Well, I was getting rejections. I was probably, I always lose count, but I feel as if I was rejected about 6 or 7 times. It was back in the day when we had incinerators in the backyard and I was very dramatic and I used to burn some of the rejections. So that's
it's like your mother and father burning their letters. I'm seeing a family tradition.
I know. So I just don't know how many times I was rejected because, and that disappoints me. I always say to people, don't throw out any of your stuff. It'll come back.
So did each rejection feel like, it felt like a rejection? Did it knock your confidence in what you were doing?
Look, it felt like a rejection. A rejection is a rejection, except there was always something, you know, sometimes I'd ring up and find a bit more information out and I'd find out, for example, that more than one person had read the manuscript. And that's progress. Other times it'd be a typed short letter, but someone would write in handwriting, "You've got such a strong voice, don't give up." And I always think it was like sometimes there was invisible ink saying this will happen. Because I wonder how much, you know, for someone back then who didn't have ego, I don't know where the drive was, but I don't think I ever wanted to be a writer. I wanted to be a writer of that novel because I had grown up reading and I had never seen myself in books. And I wanted to know that I existed beyond the world of my immediate family or my extended family and my school. So it was an extension of that, in a way. So I just kept on with it. I would obviously do rewrites, but I just kept on. And I just think, like everything in life, a great success comes out of great failure for me. So I'm a bit of a lover of failure.
Well, how did this failure transform into a success? How did Looking for Ella Brandy finally find a publisher?
Well, I wanted it out of the house because if it was in the house, I would keep on changing it around. And I finally sent it to Penguin, who are now Penguin Random House. And I was working in travel. And a couple of months later, I rang up because I wanted it back. I didn't ring up to find out how it was going. I rang back to say, "Can I have the manuscript back?" It was back in the day where you didn't have it online or anything like that. And I remember the person on the phone said, just one moment, came back and said, don't send it out to anyone else. We're seriously considering it. And it was a great shock. I remember sitting there. I hadn't told anyone around me that I was writing. I mean, you didn't go around saying I'm writing a novel. And I just thought, my goodness. And it was such an exciting feeling, but I didn't realise that it would take a couple of years of so much work to get to, you know, publishing it. But it was the biggest step and it was just amazing.
What was happening in your life when the book finally came out? What were you doing?
Well, it's interesting because it was kind of opposite to what a lot of other people do. I remember thinking, if you're smart enough to write a novel that will be published, then you're smart enough to go to university. And I think deep down, strangely, for someone who didn't, you know, do Year 11 and 12, I wanted to be a teacher. And I always say it was not my time to shine when I was at school. And that's one thing that we have to always remember about particular times in our lives. And so I was 25 years old and I went to university. And in my second year of uni, my novel came out in the same week as I failed my first English essay. And I remember I was weeping. You know, the most exciting thing in the world is going to happen, but I was just weeping because of this failure. So I blame King Lear for that.
Did you think that many people would read it? I mean, I guess every writer hopes that that will happen, but who did you think would connect with Looking for Ella Brandy?
I calculated that I probably knew about 200 people in this country, most of them from my extended family and in Queensland, and I thought 200 people will read it. And I always say this, I gave it to my younger sister to read and she said, I love it, but only people like us will, you know, relate to it. And it was just, you know, it was such a shock. It still is. I have to say, it's been 27 years. It's a beautiful shock, but, you know, when you speak to a 14-year-old kid, or if you, and I've been out around for 2 weeks and a 17-year-old turns up, and they say, oh my God, this is my life. I think, but it's got no social networking in it. How can you be relating to it? And there's just something there that's, you know, connected with people. And I'll never take it for granted. I find it difficult sometimes. It's my most flawed work. But I just, I'm always, that book changed my life. It has pushed me in directions I would never have gone, and I've loved every one of those directions. So I'm grateful for a hard work ethic, that's for sure, and imagination.
Did the success of that book change parts of yourself? Did you become a different kind of character in any ways?
I was a bit of a wallflower, and I didn't have a lot of confidence. And of course, once that book, especially, you know, was getting attention, I was doing radio. I had never done anything like that. I remember speaking at the Sydney Festival. It's when the Sydney Writers Festival used to be in January. And my parents came. My mum was there. And I remember reading out parts of the book and people were laughing. And I stopped actually in the middle to look up and think, what's going on? And people were saying later, they found it funny. But I remember when it was over, my mum said to me, I just didn't recognise who you were up there. She said, your confidence, she had never seen me on stage, you know, at school doing any debating or anything. But I was forced to have that confidence. And once again, I'm glad. And that kind of happened at the same time as I was doing teaching. So just that confidence of being in front of people and having more confidence in myself. I didn't have that when I was a teenager. And that's no one's fault but myself. But I had a lot going on in my head, which was great. But I just had to build on that. And in a strange way, because people find me very chatty, but I'm a shy person deep down, believe it or not.
Well, whatever your mum, what did your mum say to your teacher and that parent teacher?
Slow and steady wins the race.
She was right.
So,
growing up in that big family, Melina, was there always the assumption that you, as a good Italian girl, would have kids at some point?
It was my assumption, not my parents. My parents, which is amazing, have never hassled me about things to do with relationships. I remember asking my mum about it once. She said, why? She said, you were happy. Why would I, you know, why would I inflict my feelings about what you should be doing? But I think that surprised me. It surprised me that I didn't, you know, have the big family. And I always thought it would be a big family. And, you know, we had such a big extended family. There were always babies. And I don't think I had a craving for them. It was just part of our lives. It was the beauty of our lives. And, you know, women don't have children for so many different reasons. And, you know, I was saying recently, I'm sick of having to make excuses about why we didn't have children. It's no one's business. I think it's probably one of the worst questions to be asked because it's never simple. And, you know, but it did, you know, I just thought I'll always be happy being the aunt of my two nephews. I actually thought I'd never love children as much as I loved those boys, and I love them. It has not changed. I just adore them, my nephews, who are now 17 and 15, and I have a four-year-old nephew. They were just everything to us. But I just thought that's what my role is going to be. But I also knew as a teacher that I could love other people's children. And, you know, you heard so many sad stories and you just thought, oh, gosh, you know, they did break your heart. And the one thing, because I'm not saying that I don't believe in a biological clock or maternal feelings, but I always feel as if I was meant to raise a child. So then you have to start thinking, well, you know, you're the only person that can start making this happen. And we used to always talk with friends about that feeling that you have when you're standing on a railway station not getting on the train, and then 5 years later you're in the same spot. I thought, I don't want to be that. So, you know, I started when I knew that it was not going to happen in any other way, I just thought, well, you know, permanent foster care. I couldn't do short term because I could not bear the idea of returning a child. So I started inquiring about permanent.
When you started inquiring about that and began the process, were you prepared for how intense the process of being vetted to be a permanent foster carer was? What was that like?
No, I wasn't. I knew it was going to be difficult because it was permanent foster care. You know, you first off, you have to do a course. It's a generic course. And then you go through, once you get past that, you go through questions. And there's probably about 20 hours of questions. And the first time I went through it was with another organisation, not the organisation I ended up with. And it was an awful year. The lack of consistency, sometimes you didn't see them for 4 months.
So it took over a year that
you were
doing this?
It took over a year with them. And then they actually said, oh, we just can't continue on with this.
Did they say why?
One of the things they said, we just don't think you're a team player. And it really surprised me because I had worked as a year coordinator where all you were doing was being, and I thought, well, you didn't ask me the right questions.
Do you think there was something going on behind that, the fact that you were a single
woman? I feel that there was, but it was one of the most devastating moments because you're getting older and you know that your chances are getting slim. And I don't know, once again, it comes from that failure. I remember after that, I wrote, you have to write a very long life story anyway. So I had that. And I wrote a very long letter just pointing out every single thing that happened because you can't tell any lies. They will find out. And I sent it to 3 other organizations. And I said, if you're still interested in speaking to me, here's my number. And I got a phone call one day from Barnardo's, and that the journey began from there. After speaking on the phone, she said, I think you could be someone we'd be interested in speaking to. And luckily, I didn't have to do the course again because it was a very general one. And these two women came to my house, and once again, those questions began. But it's not that I was more prepared for them, but they were so much wiser. I remember one of the questions asked by the others, not by Barnardo's, but by the other company, was, do you feel as if you failed as a woman not giving birth naturally? And I actually don't, but I thought, wow, what a confronting question. I actually asked them why they asked, and I could understand they don't want someone going into looking after someone else's child if they haven't got over the fact that they never had one. But I thought, wow, you know, so it was things like that. And I remember my mum saying, you've got to write them a letter. And I said, I can't because I'm too angry, and I'll write that letter when the anger's gone. And I actually did end up writing a letter probably 8 months later. And it was after I went through the experience with Barnardo's. I hadn't found out whether I was approved yet, but I had gone through that experience and I wanted that other organisation to know this is the way process should be done. I don't know whether they're going to say yes or no, but that's why I want to write this now rather than, it did work for me. So it was just, it was a really hard time because you're really having to work things out.
Do you request a certain age or a certain gender once you get along that process?
At the very end. They don't talk about what you want until the very end. It's more about who you are, about your communities. I was so grateful for what I had at that stage as well. But by the end, I could say I wanted a girl under five. You can't pinpoint the age. I didn't try to. I'd go through shops and I wouldn't even look at clothes for a particular age because I didn't want to have an image of a four-year-old in my head and then be surprised if I got another age group. There's kind of cruel things, but you understand why. It's would you accept someone who has, you know, autism or and it was so difficult. And they'd say, you know, you don't have to tick any of the boxes. It's just we need to know what you can't handle. But I just thought, as much as I had taught boys for 10 years and I had nephews, I just felt I was doing it on my own. I understood what it felt to be a girl. So I felt that I could offer a girl a lot more. And that was my decision for saying that I wanted a girl.
What happened next after the end of the process?
It was crazy. So I was told that they would go to panel in August and they said, if you get approved, it could be between 2 months and 2 years. And I was researching a novel at the moment. I remember I got on a plane to go to Europe and I researched for 2 weeks, 2 or 3 weeks, because I thought I could be stuck for 2 years not being able to do anything. And it ended up being, I think, 3 months, because by November that year, I got a phone call and it wasn't a phone call saying you've got a 2-year-old. It was a phone call saying you've got a 1-year, 11-month-old. So all I heard was 1 year, thinking, what? And I remember when I hung up, I rang her back and I said, do I need a cot? Do I need, of course I knew that from her, but I was just in shock because I didn't think I'd get a 2-year-old. That was pretty young. And I had a 3-week transition with her where we'd meet for an hour.
Tell me about that first meeting. Where did you first encounter each other?
It was in a park. We've got photos at home and she'll say that's when I met you and we blew bubbles in the park. And when you see those photos of us in the park, you know, as nervous as I was and as she didn't know what her life was going to be, although her foster mum, who's amazing, Sharon, said she knows that her life's going to change. But when you see those photos, I always say my daughter and I were meant to be. I truly believe that. And that's where we first met, in a park blowing bubbles. And, yeah.
What had been happening in her life before you two found one another?
Well, she had been with the same family. She'd never lived with her birth family, but her birth family were around. She had lived with the same family for 2 years, who were amazing because they did not let her go, even though they didn't, that they were usually looking after kids for a couple of months here and there. But because of legal things happening, it dragged out and dragged out. So they had her for 2 years. And they were such amazing people. Their teenage daughter, Sarah, was sleeping in the corridor so that my daughter would have her own bedroom, because a foster child has to have their own room. So I just think they're the sort of people who are short-term carers. They're amazing. And I am so grateful for them because a child and their attachments in those first 2 years suffer quite, especially foster children. And my daughter didn't have to experience that. She experienced a sort of a grief, but it was just something that, you know, it wasn't change after change.
What do you remember, Melina, about driving away from the park after that first meeting?
It took me a while to be excited. People were saying, you must feel so fulfilled. This must be the best feeling. And I was just shell-shocked. And I continued to be. And then she came and lived with me.
How much longer after that first meeting?
She came to live with me on her second birthday. So it was 3 weeks after that first meeting. And it was a couple of weeks before Christmas. So it was just so overwhelming. And I used to wake up in the morning and I couldn't wait for it to be nighttime to be able to put her safely in her bed. You know, you can't just run up the road and get a coffee, you know. It was just that I could never understand when people said that they were tired having babies, because I thought that was about lack of sleep, and I thought I can do with lack of sleep. I didn't realise it's because you have to be switched on 24/7. And I always say this about my daughter, she just doesn't stop talking. So you have to be, even now, it's like, I just need a rest, you know. She's just so chatty, you know. She's just, you know, and she's got this beautiful, even now, because she's seven, you know, she'll come up with these great expressions that I can't even correct her. She's obsessed with sanitizer. So she'll come up and say, where's my sanitizer? And I can't even say to her, well, it's not called that, because I'm so charmed by her, but she just does not stop. And I found that at that beginning, I wasn't depressed, but I was just very anxious. And the strangest thing is, I remember it was January, a couple of months later, and I was pushing the pram through Westfield, of all places, this unspiritual place, and I felt this peace come over me that I knew I was going to be fine. So, yeah, it's just, you know, when people say it's easy from the beginning, or you see someone, your child, and it's, you know, from that moment on, I just think that's not true. It doesn't have to happen that fast. You're allowed to have that anxiety. Because your bond with them is amazing, but you just have to work out who you are.
How did this big Sicilian family react to the arrival of Bianca?
They were just amazing, absolutely amazing. My immediate family always was amazing. I remember the first time they had met her, a few of them had met her once before for an afternoon when her foster family came over. And then for her second birthday, we were told we could have her for that whole day, or the day before her second birthday. And I remember we were told not to overwhelm her, and we went down to Gladstone Park in Balmain, and I said to my mum, you cannot bring food. You can't do the big, you know, everyone had to be on their best behaviour.
Act Anglo, everybody.
It was just like, don't overwhelm her. So she got dropped off. We went down to the park. My parents hadn't arrived yet. She's sitting on my lap looking at the others. My brother-in-law's getting anxious, saying, maybe I should get some fish and chips. You know, it was just so funny. And then my mother turned up, you know, dressed to the nines in her church gear. But, of course, she had made sausage rolls and cakes, and the rest is history. The rest is history, you know. I just thought my mother did know best. So, and it was, once again, if I see the photos of that day, it's like we've been together forever. And, you know, there's a moment with my father when she first met my father, who's very shy. He was sitting in a chair, and her foster dad nudged me and said, check this out. And she was going to the fridge, getting a fridge magnet, handing it to my dad, walking back and forward. They didn't say a word to each other, but you could see the bond was there, and it still is. So I just think that's why I say she was meant to be. And, you know, she's fairer than I am. She's got, you know, different coloured eyes, but her mannerisms belong obviously to this crazy family.
What do you tell her about her own past?
It's very, apart from any details that might not be good, it's an open adoption, which means that she sees her birth family supervised by myself, you know, 8 times a year for 2 hours. You know, she has a life story that she can go to. There's a lot of transparency, because you can't keep things from children, but it has to be on a need-to-know basis. So I, you know, one of the things that we talk about all the time, which is a psychologist taught me this, we talk about the fact that she was in her birth mummy's tummy, but she was in my heart. And so that, you know, she always says that. So she knows I wasn't in her, she wasn't in my tummy. So she understands as much as she can. And even through the process, which was really hard, the whole court, you know, I would say that probably the toughest time in my life has been dealing with courts. But even during that time, it was good to be able to keep that away from her. And it's also good to be able to have a sort of warm relationship with her birth family, because it's in her best interest. That's the one important thing to remember, and it's actually an easy thing to remember. Is it in her best interest? And it is. So we try very hard. It's probably easier now that the court case is over. I feel as if we can all relax, including her birth parents. They're not together. But it was pretty tough going there for a while.
Are you raising her to participate in all of that Sicilian culture that was such a big part of your childhood?
It's just, you know, I always say with culture, and she's also, her birth father is of another culture, we don't put on the hat of this is us being this and this is, it's so part of our lives. And even the decisions you make. I moved when she came to live with me. I loved where we lived. It's this gorgeous little house in a great area. But I moved because I wanted her probably in a bit more of a diverse area, closer to where I grew up. Of course, I have to be 5 minutes away from everyone I know. And, you know, so as a result, not only is she exposed to, you know, Italian kids, she's exposed to Greek, Lebanese, you know, so many other cultures, so that she is exposed to everything that's got to do with her life. And, you know, for me, that's important. And it means that she's not going to grow up one day and say, I didn't know anything about, you know, where we come from. It's part of our storytelling, even in the most blasé way.
In terms of how that Sicilian identity is continuing to the next generation with your nephews, tell me about your nephew's visit to Rome recently and what reassured you and your sister about where he was staying.
It's not even that. It's just, we're so funny. It's just that Sicilian thing. I feel the ties to Sicily in a way that I didn't when I was 19, only because it's about people. It's about people here, not even people in Sicily. So my nephew's there at the moment and, you know, he's in high school and they're billeted out and, you know, he's got asthma and my sister reassured us that he's the person looking after him there. Is a doctor, you know, so she said, if anything happens, I'm a doctor, don't worry. But when my nephew got there, so he's living in Rome, he said to my sister, oh, by the way, they're Sicilian. They moved up from Sicily and the whole family was, oh my God, that's fantastic. Even my mother texted, thank God he's with a good family, you know. And it was just that idea that no one looks after you like Sicilians look after you, but only because that's how we grew up. So it's so funny to get to a particular age and think, oh, my God, I've turned into my parents, you know. It's that raising your child with the same, you can't do this, you can't do that, but, of course, there's a bit more leniency because we would never have been able to go on our own when we were 15.
How can a qualified medical practitioner compete with a Sicilian?
I know. That poor woman, she's done so much more in life. And
Melina, what a delight to meet you and what a beautiful story. Thank you so much for coming on Conversations.
Thank you.
Podcast, broadcast, Conversations with Sarah Konoski.
I spoke with Melina Marchetta in 2019, just after she published The Place on Dalhousie Street. And since then, Melina's been writing a junior fiction series called What Zola Did. This episode of Conversations was produced by Nicola Harrison. The executive producer was Carmel Rooney. I'm Sarah Konoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Konoski. For more Conversations episodes, head to ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.